It's like we believe that when one man is chosen to be president, suddenly he rises above all the rest of us. And why are we continually disappointed in presidents? Because they couldn't possibly live up to the powers and the faith that we're investing in them.
Escape from Imagination Land, Part 2 of 3, The Emotional Incentives of Fantasy. Critical thinking, insinuation. When we consider all of the power and the faith that most people invest in government, maybe that tiny little group of people who have called themselves president is actually not the source of most people's disappointment and dissatisfaction. Just saying, maybe.
Let us be united for peace. I have initiated a plan of action which will enable me to keep that pledge.
Well, you know, all this is all, frankly, it's moot. We don't care who knocked out which. The question is who wins now. And at this point, we are going to get the shit out of them. We're going to win this, whatever the cost. Huh?
The more support I can have from the American people, the sooner that pledge can be redeemed.
And it, just so they don't hit Hanoi or Haiphong, shouldn't be hit because they're symbols, but hit anything else.
For the more divided we are at home, the less likely the enemy is to negotiate at Paris.
Second point, with regard to the airstrikes, your feeling that we ought to use TAC air in there. They don't want to do that, huh?
Let us be united for peace.
In the meantime, now that we've got these people where they are, let's punish them, and punish them hard. Because it may be correct. It may be the country will accept it now. But let me say, I told Hall of them today, I don't care. I mean, I told him I don't want to see another poll for the next month. I said, the thing to do is to do what is right, and I'm not going to be influenced by it.
Let us also be united against defeat. Because let us understand, North Vietnam cannot defeat or humiliate the United States. Only Americans can do that.
Any area where the enemy, like the B-3 front, may be going back, we'll follow them and hit them. They're going to do that. Okay.
This was the moment when the rise of the oceans began to slow and our planet began to heal.
I will keep taxes low.
I will cut taxes.
To balance the federal budget.
We will guarantee health care for anyone who needs it.
He will bring peace and stability to the United States.
He almost sounds like Superman.
When you're running for president, you gotta be Superman.
Woke up this morning, started to snooze. Had a cigarette and a cup of tea. I looked in the mirror, what did I see? A 9-stone weakling with no belly knees. I did my knees bent, press ups, touch my toes. Had another sneeze and I blew my nose. I looked in the mirror at my pigeon chest. I had to put on my clothes because it made me depressed.
At the end of this decade, in the year 1980, the United States will not be dependent on any other country for the energy we need to provide our jobs, to heat our homes, and to keep our transportation moving.
First, we must reduce oil imports by 1 million barrels per day by the end of this year, and by 2 million barrels per day by the end of 1977.
Beginning this moment,
I wanna be like Superman.
This nation will never use more foreign oil.
Conservation is not the sole answer
than we did in 1977. Now,
to our energy needs. America must get to work producing
an energy future that is secure, efficient,
and for every new dollar we sought to invest in clean, efficient sources of energy, they have provided a dime. Today, I urge Congress to get off
on this and other new technologies will help us reach another great goal.
And take action.
To replace more than 75% of our oil imports from the Middle East by 2025.
We will set a clear goal as president. In 10 years, we will finally end our dependence on oil from the Middle East.
At the end of this decade.
In 10 years.
In 1977.
In the year 1980.
2025.
And most importantly, yeah, I want to open up the government back to the American people because
I do believe in the American dream.
In our day, certain economic truths have become accepted as self-evident.
I believe there is such a thing as the American
dream. A second Bill of Rights.
Owning a home is a part of that dream. It just is. Right here in America, if you own your own home, you realize that you're
American. Under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station.
First of all, government-sponsored corporations that helped create our mortgage system. I introduced two of the leaders here today. They call those people Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
The right of every family to a decent home.
Will increase their commitment to minority markets by more than
$440
billion.
At home or abroad. The right to adequate medical care. And the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health, the right to a good education. All of these rights spell security. And after this war is won, we must be prepared to move forward in the implementation of these rights to new goals of human happiness and well-being. For unless there is security here at home, there cannot be lasting peace in the world.
We strive for peace.
And I am increasing the search for every possible path to peace.
We maintain our strength in order to deter and defend against aggression, to preserve freedom and peace.
We strive for peace.
Freedom and peace.
Peace in the world.
Our desire for peace.
The United States wants peace.
We seek peace. We strive for peace. Let us be united for peace.
Alrighty, should we get this road on the show?
Yeah, I think we should. So, Wes, what I think I need your help with is I have a pretty filthy pig that I have to put some lipstick on here. And I had just done this show about relationships with Mike and Stephanie from Pork Therapy, and then I did this episode of School News where I was pretty acrimonious towards these two public school teachers. One got busted for pot and the other one got busted in a prostitution sting. And I made it about, instead of doing the hypocrisy angle, which I've beaten to death on my show, I made it about congratulating them, the prostitute guy, for his ability to establish a voluntary relationship with a prostitute, you know, not coercing somebody, and the teacher for showing that, you know, demonstrating principles of self-ownership and the fact that adults can do what they want in their own home and with their own body. And, you know, when I looked at these two shows together, I'm like, well, you know, here I am kind of revealing some that in my life I've had some pretty significant failures and missteps in understanding the importance of personal freedom. And then I've made a habit, not just in this show, but this is where it really hit me in this school news show that I did. But like ever since you and I started working together,
I've been pretty ready to rip into people for their failure to understand political freedom. You know, even though...
yeah, so it's all my fault, Brett. You can just shirk the guilt onto me.
Well, no, but I mean, it gets encouraged by everybody because it's entertaining. Like, you know, the speech I did at the Liberty Forum where I kind of went into these, these dialogues that I had with the left and right side of the hypocritical spectrum there and kind of, you know, ha, 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 but it gets old and it's not really productive. And I started to think, could I use some of my more recent realizations about personal freedom to develop some empathy and some understanding and kind of really some curiosity for what's going on behind the scenes in these political conversations or the failure of people to understand the issue of political freedom?
The political arguments are kind of ripe for the picking. Once you've studied Austrian economics and maybe some of the objectivist principles and read about voluntarism. I mean, you really sharpen your sword to take on all these ideas, and it's pretty easy and, like you say, pretty tempting to just, engage in these arguments without really delving into the psychologies behind the ideas that are being promoted, right?
Well, yeah, because, I mean, like I've talked about my experience in the past. I was a history teacher, and I got very interested through that in politics and economics. And I used to think years ago, if I just gained enough knowledge of history and historical facts, and I just had a strong enough understanding of economics, that I could take these facts to people and there would be this moment where they would say, oh, well, I never knew that. That changes everything. But what I realized is that history by itself or just economic theory by itself history especially is just like this cold hallway of statues and monuments. You need the philosophy piece and you need the psychology piece to really animate that and make it real for people. There was never going to be that catharsis where people just said, oh, Brett, I get it. Thanks for all the facts. Because what I
– Yeah, very, very seldom do you run into an epiphany, right, with the person.
No, yeah, it's very, very rare. And I'm glad to say that there is some curiosity on the part of some people. But what I realized, not through anything political or economic or educational or anything related to my own studies, what I realized through my own personal missteps and my own realization was that the goal was not understanding. The goal was not to reach a consensus. The goal for these people was fantasy, was the perpetuation
and to continue
fantasy.
And to continue sleepwalking through one's existence in a sense, because it's not so much the knowledge. We can bring the knowledge to people, but we soon find that there's all this resistance to it, which is kind of odd for us because the people that really are immersed in these ideas were kind of out there on the fringe in terms of really having an interest in these ideas and really wanting to explore it and share it with other people. And you soon find out that there's really not that curiosity. So the question then becomes why? Why is there this resistance? And you're touching on the motivations behind it. You know, why would someone want to turn away from the truth that's presented to them in a really articulate fashion? And I think it is about empathy, trying to find out why it is they're turning away from the truth, why they're not wanting to live more consciously, why they're not wanting to take more responsibility for their own intellect, their own independence, psychological independence and intellectual independence. Right?
Exactly. And, you know, it wasn't until, you know, I read a book like Real Time Relationships or started looking at Nathaniel Brandon's work. And, of course, all along the way, you've kind of been encouraging people to do those very things with your show. But it wasn't until I had these own personal realizations that I said, boy, you know, all along the way, I just thought and, you know, got a few laughs with kind of presenting the idea that these people were just stupid and incapable. And it's really not the truth. It really is. I know we've touched on this many times before on your show and mine, that it's not intellectual, that it is very, very much emotional. And yeah, I mean, I think that trying to, by using my own personal experience, like I kind of feel like I went at all this backwards sometimes. Like I've referred to myself as the lucky libertarian because I backed into this. You know, like we kind of have to break out of all these shells to get to, ultimate political freedom or an ultimate stateless society, but the first and the hardest one to break is the personal one, is really the, you know, kind of getting, you know, that whole integrity versus conformity kind of thing, where conformity has always been so comfortable. So for me, you know, always being immersed in history and politics, it was very easy for me to start on the outside, you know what I mean? And kind of work my way in, which is not what I would recommend.
Coming at it from an intellectual angle rather than an emotional one, right?
Yeah, or working like it's so easy to put the focus on politicians and the state and, you know, the institutions of education or central banking and put all your focus there and never realize the trap that you're in, you know, emotionally, psychologically, on a personal level. So there was like this realization for me at least made me want to investigate ways to change my whole approach when trying to present these ideas to other people.
Yeah, I think that's a really great way to go. And I commend Stéphane Molyneux for really turning up the volume on this part, really putting the focus on this personal sort of ethics, the alignment with virtue, honesty, integrity, and courage. Because I was listening to a NeuroScene podcast recently, and they were talking about what segment of the brain dedicates to cognitive versus evaluative functioning. And I think it was about 40% of the brain's processing is emotional, right? And so roughly half of the brain is always calculating things in terms of how a person's feeling, the emotions that they're having. Is this good for me or bad for me? Just the succession of evaluations that are always happening. And when you start talking about ideas, there is that immediate subconscious processing of what are the implications of these ideas to my own life, to my own relationships, to my family, to the person I'm with in a relationship, my friends and so forth, coworkers even, you know, so that's always going on there. And I think that's where the crux of the resistance is for not accepting these liberty ideas and basic ideas about freedom. This isn't really rocket science either. You know, don't hit people, don't take their stuff, respect property rights. And there you have it, basically.
Yeah, and I think that there's a significant amount of interplay between, you know, the personal and the political. We've talked about this too, just in our own conversations, that there's kind of this tug of war that we can experience between, you know, in our own lives and in our personal relationships between emotion and reason. And sometimes, you know, emotion can tug hard, you know, and put reason momentarily or temporarily in the mud. And, you know, I Indeed. Think that when people have that snap to reaction, when you start talking about, you know, the evils of the state or the evils of government education, for so long for me, it was just like, oh, well, you know, you're not listening or you're an idiot. And when I really, again, tried to start to focus more on, I guess, what I could call the meta talk of these conversations, I went about it all the wrong way, because I would say something like, what is it that I'm saying that's scaring you so much? Which is essentially like saying, have you stopped beating your wife? Kind of embedding the accusation that you're just a coward. To say but when you change the question, which I eventually learned to do, because that just, you know, saying, well, why do I scare you so much? To how do the things I say make you feel? Yeah. Then the people hurling emotions back and forth at each other. And if you think about just how involuntary most people's reactions are to the idea of getting rid of government education, it's not even like tossing emotions at people. It's like, you know, it's so involuntary. It's like sneezing outrage on people. Pretty much. Mm-hmm. So that quieted all of that down. And I felt like with a lot of people who actually turned out to be quite reachable, there was progress that could be made by kind of looking at what was behind the scenes. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Asking, are you aware of what you're feeling right now? Mm-hmm. And that can be a daunting challenge too, because the people that are in most need of psychotherapy are those who will probably last seek it, or if they ever seek it. So usually people that are really resistant to basic ideas about freedom have a lot of subconscious stuff, a lot of conflicts and emotional turmoil that they're not wanting to address. So once you start lifting that lid up and peering inside, it can open up another set of issues. But if they're willing to be vulnerable, if they're willing to really kind of relate to you in terms of what they're feeling, you can definitely make a lot of headway, because now you're showing a level of empathy that they may have not ever experienced. I mean, how many people actually get asked the question, what are you feeling right now? You know, how are you responding to what I'm saying? Like, what's the impression you get from what I'm saying? How are you perceiving this?
Yeah, right? Well, I think when 95% of us have spent our lives pretty much from our first memory, at least until the age of 18, being trained for the convenience of future managers, there isn't a real feedback loop. There is no suggestion box there. People are not asking you, well, how do you feel about this? There is no opportunity for feedback. And I think that people ultimately learn, we actually just talked about this, I talked about this with Mike and Stephanie, that people learn that there's a kind of shame in emotion, that's something that needs to be kept inside because they're so used to having no outlet for it. And by the time that it does kind of blow out, it's usually something when we're young that is like a punishable offense. So people yeah. learn to, and this is so true in romantic relationships too, that by the time it blows out, it's not exactly a punishable offense, but it creates more problems. It comes with resentment. So yeah, I mean, this meta talk, this behind the scenes stuff is just not something people have a lot of experience with.
No, they don't. And like you say, there's no outlet for their emotional vocabulary. They don't even really develop an emotional vocabulary. So they act out, you know, they get involved in drugs and bad crowds of people and just start doing things that really are not in service to their lives and well-being. They're not in accordance with rational self-interest and living a very happy, virtuous life. So it really is a systemic problem. Like, how do you create an environment in which people are invited to say what they're feeling? Because again, it's like half of our mental world is emotion. And yet it's only given just a sliver of attention, you know? And like you say, it is kind of just relegated to a dark recess. You know, there's really no sort of reaching out to people and understanding what they're feeling. And oftentimes there's all kinds of alarm bells going off emotionally, because as you pointed out on your podcast so many times, the system is set up to deny people from feeling, you know, persecuted or disrespected or any of those things. It's treated as normal. Like that, all that stuff, all that damage that's inflicted on kids is treated as normal. And so what do you do with your emotions when you're in a system in which what you're feeling is completely dissonant with what people are expecting of you or foisting upon you? You know, what do you do with those emotions?
Part of there are all these things that happen to us when we're young and when we're adults and we're having these conversations, or we'll just say coming from a more that comfortable statist point of view, I would talk to these people and I would be listening to them and I would think, wow, you know, your thought process is just like this debris filled cyclone. You're not even concerned at all that there's absolutely no order to it at all. But like I said, the goal is fantasy, because I think that because these outlets don't exist and because people don't ever have any genuine way to feel rewarded, it, just to stick with that metaphor, it does kind of lead to this perfect storm, this perfect status storm in adulthood, where most people, I honestly believe, they want to be good, right? They want to have a positive impact in the lives of the people that they think they care about. But they also want to be efficacious. They also want to feel powerful. Right. But because, like I said, for so long, people are trained for the convenience of managers, they don't feel any potency. And I think that this perfect storm is that they put these fantasies about not only being good, but also being powerful into the state as this sort of heroic concept that they can be a part of. And all of these good things can happen. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they wrap their identity up in these things that have really nothing to do with them. And they kind of get a sense of pseudo self-esteem, as Nathaniel Brandon calls it, a false sense of efficacy and a false sense of worth by being part of this statist racket, if you will, or these ideas that really are damaging to individuality and damaging to self-esteem itself. So as long as they can look around and see other people doing the same sort of disconnect, then it seems okay. But deep down, there's a rational part of their self. Like, everyone has this part of yourself from a child self point of view. You really wanted to look at the world in a rational way. You wanted to understand things. You wanted things to be comprehensible. You wanted to just make sense of the world, make sense of yourself, and understand what the adult world is about. And because most adults really come up short in that process when they're trying to convey things to kids, to say the least, that part of self becomes disowned in a sense, but it's still there. And that's why people do have the anxiety and the guilt and the shame and the fear, because there's a part of themselves, the wiser part, that knows that they're kind of betraying that sense of rationality, being connected with reality, being able to understand yourself and others in a way that's beneficial and not antagonistic and based on win-win situations rather than win-lose and power plays and all that disrespectful stuff.
But I think we agree that this political anxiety management that most people do, or this, you know, reflexive defense of the state, of the education, of the tax system, whatever, of the military, that's, you really don't think that that's happening on a conscious level. I mean, because it happens so fast. I mean, like, if I were to express these ideas and say, you know, I'm interested in maybe over the process of a generation or two, doing my part to see if we can evolve into a societies based on voluntary relationships, or I really think that we can slowly phase out the government education system. And, you know, one of the things I've always appreciated about my father, who's remarkably curious for somebody his age, was, okay, tell me more. All right, you've piqued my interest. But then I've also dealt with people who just react, sneeze, you know what I mean? That response.
Yeah.
Now, that's not really conscious, right? They really tell themselves a story that I'm, or you or me or anyone coming from our point of view, is just insane or stupid.
Yeah, it's the equivalent of when people suppress feelings, that's a conscious act. When you're dedicating your time and effort to a certain task and you can't really get really emotional because it'll distract you, so you suppress that emotion and deal with it later. Well, if you continue doing that in a way that's not so healthy, it becomes repressed, right? So repression is the automatized aspect of suppression, or the process by which you set emotions aside. So this is basically doing the same thing in the intellectual realm. Just reflexively, in an automatized way, rationalizing something. But there's a sense, I think they do know, obviously, as Stefan has pointed out, they know that there's minds out in that field. When they say there's no minds out there, they walk out there and they strategically avoid every single one of them, right? So they know what topics not to broach. They know what, you know, sort of sneezes to come at you with in order to distract and to basically not address the issue. So it is an automatized process, but I think to make them more aware of that process and to ask these really good questions that are curious about where they're coming from emotionally, maybe can build that bridge to them so that they can start looking at themselves with a little bit more awareness, perhaps.
Yeah, and I think that I've seen progression with this too, and it's not a healthy progression for some people that, you know, I've continuously tried, just because they have a strong interest in politics, or they claim to have some understanding of economics, or they claim to have some dog in the fight of the whole education thing. In the beginning, you know, we talk, you used Steph's minds metaphor. I think I described it in an earlier show. Because these ideas, I mean, people have never, the things that we're saying, just as far as political people are concerned, they've never been given an opinion to have. You know, we're not talking about abortion. We're not talking about healthcare. They have never, through the media or through their favorite political leaders, they have never been given an opinion on any of these issues, as Harry Brown, I think, once pointed out. So it's such a departure from any conversation where they feel comfortable, that initially it will very much be like, and I don't mean to be insulting to any of these people, but it very much in the beginning is like the mouse running into the field of mouse traps. They just full speed ahead. And as time goes on, it's the conversations on their part are executed more like a game of Minesweeper, where they're kind of putting a flag here. Okay, I don't go there. That's a mine. Right. So it becomes, even though, you know, I understand the metaphor of like walking through a minefield and pretending there's no mines, these people are now consciously aware that mines are there, and they will carefully try to steer conversations, you know, using avoidance or, you know, changing subjects or ad hominem attacks to not step on those mines that they are now very, very aware of. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a definite process. And again, it's like, what are the implications of these ideas to their personal life? I think that's kind of where the psychology is in play. And if people really reflect on it, they realize that, well, if I advocate freedom, I mean total freedom, complete liberty, so that people can use their property as they see fit, make decisions with other people in the marketplace in a voluntary fashion, and there is no coercion used except in self-defense, right? When you're getting your property back or in the process of, you know, righting a wrong that's been done or alleged to have been done, when there's no more of this preemptive preventive law, when there's no more aggression that's being arbitrarily foisted on people based on collectivistic notions like nation and state and city and all this slave speak that we have in our culture, when you really drill down, you find out that, well, if I do advocate relinquishment of all those bad ideas, what is that going to imply to my personal relationships and the nature of the stuff that's been foisted on me in terms of mythology since I was little in my family and in school? Like, you have to go against all that, and it can be really emotionally tumultuous to do that, to really reflect on that and actually take that step towards getting out of the matrix, if you will. Because really, like you say, they're all in midstream. This is politics in midstream. Like the last podcast I did, 121, I played that clip from NPR, and they interviewed a couple of poli-sci students about, you know, their trust in government or faith in government. And it's all about politics in midstream. You know, they're not striking the root. They're not standing on the bank and looking at it objectively and say, what is politics? Why do we need this branch of philosophy? You know, what are the philosophical principles involved, the first principles that we need to reason from in order to understand this stuff in a comprehensible way, which is kind of like asking a person, how can you use your mind in an efficacious fashion? Because your mind is able to grasp these things, it's able to find clarity. Now, why is it that it's so difficult?
Well, I just think that, you know, in many ways people feel so beaten down, and a lot of this, I believe, comes from childhood and family, and certainly whatever, you know, whatever isn't taken care of there for most people is finished off in school, you know, as far as nails in the coffin are concerned. The feeling of powerlessness is really significant, and the emotional incentives of fantasy are on the surface and in the short run just too rewarding. You know, it's so, like, I remember I had this falling out recently with a family member, with an uncle of mine, who I would, you know, I would call a liberal, not that that's very important to this conversation, but throughout all of our interactions, I mean, he's somebody who, you know, lives around us. He's my mother's brother. He's close. There's family gatherings that are important to me, you know, because I have nieces and nephews, and I care about seeing my mother, and I care about seeing my brothers, and he's going to be there. And through the years, and this kind of as I've explored these things a little bit deeper, I've realized that he's never been particularly good at offering support, offering empathy, being, you know, there when people, my brothers or myself, were going through difficult times in our life. And almost his input was almost counterproductive, was more negative than positive. But this is somebody who extols the virtues of the welfare system in this country. Right now, it doesn't matter. Like I said, facts don't matter. So if I start doing statistics with him about, well, you know, every dollar that you pay in taxes that doesn't wind up as, you know, metal or shrapnel or some projectile lodged in a needy person in some other country, whatever's left over to contribute to the needy people in this country, 80 cents out of that dollar is shaved off to pay the salaries of middle class bureaucrats. And then you just get this 20%. That does not matter. That's disruptive to the fantasy, and that's usually where the attacks happen. So as I was saying, the personal becomes the political. If this person feels like they have no efficacy, because I don't think this person wakes up in the morning and says, I'm going to find surprising and exciting new ways to be an asshole to the people I claim to care about today. Right. I think yeah. He wants to be good, and I think that his own childhood and his own, you know, undealt with emotions are just so torturous that he needs to, because he doesn't feel efficacious in his own life. Like, he doesn't feel like he can be helpful. Now, I'm speculating here, obviously, but I think this makes sense. He's had to create this fantasy of, you know, just like he's this virtuous philanthropist, which is just reframing his obedience to the state. Because that's the only way that he's ever going to get that feeling that I think all, even, you know, anybody who's not a psychopath wants. You know, they want that feeling of I'm good, but they also want that feeling of I make a difference. And that's the only way that this person is ever going to get it. And I started to develop, well, this is somebody that I put an incredible amount of distance between he and myself, and I really don't have much of an interest in continuing that relationship. It was interesting that we mentioned Free Domain several times. Well, I always used to make him these CDs because my family is a pretty good example of how this older generation is kind of not aware of all of this information that's at their fingertips for free on the internet.
Podcasts? What are podcasts?
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. So I would make these CDs for him, and you know, when we first started having political discussions, when my interest first peaked in this, well, I was a liberal and he's a liberal and Bush was president. So great, we get along. But then as I learned more and studied more and understood more and transitioned more towards libertarianism, even minarchism or political libertarianism at first, well, George Bush was still president. So now I was getting radical, but we still had some common ground. When Bush changed to Obama and I still spoke the same language, well, that really strained our relationship. And he would listen to these CDs and he would say, oh, you're pretty radical, but, you know, a lot of this stuff makes sense. And he would get a little bit more apprehensive as I started to mix in Complete Liberty. You know, like I've said to you before, this guy's talking over 99% of people's heads, right? Just because you're saying mm-hmm. things that he doesn't want to hear, even though he's smart and he can understand it. Free Talk Live, sure. Mises Media. And finally, the last CD that I ever gave him, no, not that I ever gave him, but that I know he ever put in his CD player, contained in an episode of Free Domain Radio, one of the true news shows about voting. Now, liberals, I think, especially have this fantasy about democracy, right? Which goes back to the debris-filled cyclone where they say, oh, our government is virtuous because it's run by the people. It has the input of the people. And then if the follow-up question is like, okay, then if the people's input makes this thing that's just otherwise based on theft and violence virtuous, why do we need that thing? Oh, well, because the people are so stupid and helpless. Really? So
they can't be trusted.
Right, but they're right. The thing that makes this violent institution virtuous. That's interesting. That's probably something that's worth exploring. So when he heard Steph talk about voting and how voting is not just like an insult to your intelligence as far as like thinking you're free is concerned, but you're actually also contributing or encouraging violence and aggression.
Suggestion box for slaves.
Exactly.
Right?
When we're talking about democracy, I said, I guarantee that at some point in history, two plantation owners were having a conversation. Or I don't guarantee it, but this is likely. Two plantation.
Maybe not money back.
But. Yeah, two plantation owners are having a conversation where one of them says to the other one, hey, do you think if we put out a suggestion box every month, we could eventually get the slaves to blame themselves for their condition? And maybe the other guy said, if we keep them dumb enough, we can probably get away with doing it once a year.
And it might even boost morale. It might even get them thinking that hey, this lifestyle isn't too bad. We get to give a say in what we do here.
Yeah, maybe for the really important decisions, they could just get the suggestion box every 4 years or 6 years. You could even tell them that they're free eventually and they'd believe it. So when he's confronted, you know, after kind of listening through all of this stuff and giving me feedback, when he's confronted by this guy telling him the truth about voting. Now, of course, it's like, that guy's an asshole. I couldn't stand the sound of his voice. He's self-righteous.
Good old Ed Hoffman.
Exactly,
huh?
exactly. I can't listen to somebody like that who thinks they know everything. And I'm not interested in your CDs anymore. And never even listened to a School Sucks podcast. Never even was too afraid of what might be on these CD, just these blank, mysterious looking recordable CDs that I would give him that nothing else was ever listened to. But you know, now at the time I said, God, what an idiot. How could he not understand that? It's right in his face. It's so obvious. I mean, this is somebody who's been lied to for 40 years by every politician. You know, he's just like this lonely, vulnerable woman in a bar, and these guys just keep coming up and promising the world, and you know, he gets screwed, and then he's back there the next night. You know, having the same conversation with somebody else. I mean, that's really what participating in politics, I think, would feel like. But for me, despite condemning him at that point for his failure to understand this, same author, same presenter, Stefan Molyneux, shortly thereafter, I'm reading his book, Real Time Relationships. I get 80 pages into it and I shut it. And I say, I might not be ready for that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So there's my new kind of understanding. Now, that was quite some time ago. When I eventually did read through the whole book, I knew the relationship that I was in was already over. But there's an anxiety. There's a real anxiety when somebody tells you the truth kind of and just obliterates the fantasies that you get so much comfort from, personal or political.
Yeah, it's almost as if it's an architecture, a structure that's been built to support a sense of self-esteem, even though it's a false sense, right? And when that is pierced, when that is damaged, or when you feel the impending sort of disintegration of that structure, it can cause you to push away and to evade and to rationalize and not orient yourself toward the truth, even though if you follow the truth, which is basically alignment with reality, that's why the virtue of honesty is so key, because you're aligning yourself with reality. A conceptual consciousness, a human mind, is designed to understand reality in a non-contradictory way. And in order to do that, you need to be aligned with reality, not cheating reality, not faking it, not pretending, not, you know, fogging the truth for others. Not fogging the truth for yourself, but just aligning yourself with reality. If you do that, you're gonna reach that goal that you always want, which is the virtuous life, being good, being worthy, right? Being fit for existence, being good enough. And you are by virtue of living and breathing on this planet. So it's just a matter of kind of brushing aside these false structures that are in the way of aligning yourself with reality. And so I guess it's incumbent upon us to kind of help people understand that really what we're presenting is a better way of life for you, right? Whatever your context is now, if you adopt truth in your life, it's going to be better for you, even though you may not feel that it's better now because you're relying on these false support structures for a pseudo sense of self-esteem, and your self-concept really isn't oriented towards reality so much as falsehood and fantasy and false self stuff. So I guess it's just a challenge to try to get people to understand that the truth is what actually sets us free, to use the cliche, but it's what really enables us to be real, right? Be real with ourselves and reality and strip away mythology from our lives so that we can actually progress in a way that's logical and that's wholesome, that's aligned with happiness, because happiness is our highest moral purpose. And it's really hard to be happy when you're not living consciously, when you're not taking responsibility, when you're evading certain truths, when you're upholding pretense. I mean, pretentiousness is really problematic for achieving authentic self-esteem. because again, you're pretending that you have self-esteem that you don't, or that you understand things that you don't. And so you're not trusting your mind to understand. You're kind of short-circuiting that process and saying, oh, I already know it, or you're wrong. You know, you're not being real with yourself, and you're not being real with other people. And then you're not going to be real with your own life and your perspective on what really matters.
Absolutely. And, you know, I have this young audience, and I certainly am not short on time in this show explaining to them how all of this is obscured and the extrinsic motivators and sort of that robbery of self, period, you know?
Yeah.
So I know this might be kind of a tricky question, but based on the things that we've talked about so far, because so many people are in just this incredibly soul-crushing, completely false environment, what do you think are some strategies that could that people could employ tomorrow to start working towards that more authentic life?
I think that the value of self-esteem should be preeminent in your life. Objectivist ethics holds reason, purpose, and self-esteem as the top values. And for good reason, because reason is your ability to identify and integrate reality and using logic in a non-contradictory way. Purpose, dedicating your mind in a creative fashion to achieving things, to show in reality through concrete steps that you are efficacious, that you can achieve things. And self-esteem as that inviolate belief in yourself that you can be happy, that you are worthy of happiness, that you can achieve all the things that you want if you dedicate your mind and life to these certain values and these corresponding virtues, which are rationality, productivity, and pride. And pride, of course, is really denigrated in religion. Pride goeth before the fall, right? Mm-hmm. So there's all kinds of anti-self-esteem beliefs in our culture that really need to be challenged. But I think the most important thing is to, say, pick up the six pillars of self-esteem and understand those pillars from an emotional perspective. What is preventing you from adopting more and more of those things? Nathaniel Brandon uses a sentence completion exercise that's pretty innocuous. It seems doable because it's not setting up such a huge jump in one's emotional evolution. He'll say something like, if I were 5% more self-responsible in my relationships, ... and provide endings to that. So these sentence completion endings enable you to, you know, slowly progress to that level of authenticity that everyone actually possesses as a child. Because again, they're just purely trying to understand in a curious fashion, like a little scientist, you know, picking up things, putting them in their mouth, playing with stuff. You know, all these different manipulations that kids do to understand the world. And so this is kind of getting back to your true self, right? By reading a book called The Six Pillars of Self-Esteem, that's a great start. If you're in a lot of emotional turmoil and you need some really good skills, some practical things to do to get yourself in a better state of mind, a great workbook and actually theoretical book is called Feeling Good, The New Mood Therapy by David Burns. And it's based on cognitive behavioral therapy. And the premise is, and this is completely validated empirically, if you change the way you're thinking on a subconscious level, you'll change the way you're feeling about things. Because if people are depressed, for example, they're depressing. They're having trains of thought that are evaluating themselves as bad or not good enough or unfit to exist or what's the point. All these super rapid assessments in their mind are happening that is generating the depressed sort of feelings and mindset and mood. So this is about basically trying to pinpoint where am I thinking irrationally and replacing those irrational assumptions and evaluations with something that's rational and actually real, that's based on the evidence. And your mood lifts, your spirits get raised, and you become happier as a consequence. So that's another great book. You and I both have espouse the art of self-discovery, I think, as the really good workbook to do your own self-therapy.
Yeah.
But also, you know, in relation to real-time relationships, to find people in your life that are receptive to these ideas, that are curious and want to actually read real-time relationships and then try to do RTRing with each other, being able to just purely express what you're feeling without any accusations, without any expectations, with just from a standpoint of inner curiosity, in a sense, and really genuinely communicating with another person on an emotional level. I think everyone can learn a lot through that process. That's just some of the initial things.
And whether we're talking about a personal or a political level and how those things kind of are intertwined in many ways, when, you know, you get that response from somebody, when you start bringing up things that challenge their comfort zone, and, you know, the response is antagonistic and immediate, never mistake that as any kind of reasoned argument. I mean, what you're dealing with there is essentially an anxiety attack. And while I would in the past pursue, whether it was in the personal or the political realm, I would pursue these conversations with people. I would take their bait a lot of the times. I think it's very important for people to understand, you know, just when you're having a conversation and when you're not.
Yes.
And I think...
And what's the real conversation about?
Exactly, right? Exactly. And I think that just back to Brandon's books, the Art of Self-Discovery, which is a workbook with those sentence completion exercises, really can help, from my experience with it. The subconscious is really such an enormous store of, you know, past feelings, emotions. And I think that so much of our energy goes into the buzzing of our senses, and our brain is just processing so many, you know, billions of pieces of information, you know, throughout the day, that all of that stuff does kind of, you know, so much of it anyway, does kind of wind up in this reservoir. And it's really worth exploring, because there's a lot of answers there.
Yeah. And he has other books too, theoretical one, Honoring the Self, which is kind of, a precursor to the six pillars of self-esteem. It actually has the pillars in there, just not explicitly defined as such or articulated as such. That's a great book. His seminal book is The Psychology of Self-Esteem, which he wrote as he was teaching objectivism, philosophy of Ayn Rand. All those books are really important. And of course, psychotherapy is another way, a very, very important way to relate to another person who is empathetic and understanding and can reflect back some of the things that we may be missing, you know, because again, this subconscious, as you say, is a vast continent that's worth exploring, that needs to be explored, especially since it integrated a lot of junk, essentially.
Yeah.
Early on, the evaluations of self, you know, everyone has this inner critic, the judge, and lots of motivational books have been written about how to overcome that. There's an author named Timothy Galway that wrote a whole bunch of books called The Inner Game of Tennis and Inner Golf and Inner Skiing. And it's about how to sort of silence this part of self that is really critical, you know, like a really authoritarian coach or something. Like, why did you do it that way? You should do it this way. All that kind of nonsense, you know, but he's using more of like a Buddhist kind of perspective, an Asian philosophy that I don't necessarily think is most productive, because I think in order to get through this stuff, you have to meet it head on and you have to really become compassionate and empathetic towards those parts of self that are really critical, that are wanting your attention in some way, and to suppress or repress those things is just dangerous for your own well-being. So to actually explore that subconscious continent and become more and more aware of your inner world. I mean, nothing could be more fulfilling than that. That should be everyone's priority on the planet, given all the mythologies and crazy sort of ideas and behaviors that are going on, for people to really start connecting with reality, the inner reality in relation to external reality, to become more objective about this stuff. Because, you know, we're kind of in the age of pre-logic now. Because many ideas are just passed off as normal and perfectly fine and actually good, even though they're completely contradictory. So how are people to make sense of that? And incidentally, the subconscious should be differentiated from psychoanalysis' idea of unconscious, you know, the Freudian sort of stuff, where there's all these different things going on that we have no way to access. They just reveal themselves and the id impulses and so forth. I think that's also a detrimental way to look at human psychology, because the subconscious is just that. It's on the periphery. It's all of our memories, and we can retrieve these things. And when we focus on them, we can learn more about them and understand them, so we can integrate them with ourselves. We can own those disowned parts of ourselves, rather than constantly thinking that we're being run by a bunch of strange demons or something like that.
Right.
You know?
And we can eventually live in reality. You mentioned the phrase you've used a lot, this age of pre-logic that we're hopefully, emerging out of. I think that most of human history, or almost all of, recorded human history or civilization, has existed in imagination land, essentially, where throughout most of time, regardless of what the concern was or the fear or the question, people just didn't have a handful of Xanax to shove in their mouth. So they, we start with religion, which helps manage all kinds of anxiety about.
Yeah, they did have witch doctors, Brett.
Exactly. Right. So, but I mean, that's a sort of mysticism, and religion was so handy for thousands of years to manage anxiety about, Steve died, and where did he go, and why are we here, and what is this thing we're on, and where did the sun go, and that even can get into ethics, and religion helps people manage that anxiety about what is good, what is right, what is just. And as we started to see the light at the end of the tunnel of imagination land, or the age of pre-logic, religion just became the state. So now the state can help people manage this anxiety about what is good. I am good. I contribute to the state. The state helps people. And it also can help them manage, just as religion help people manage their anxiety about the future, the state does exactly the same thing. The state does these good things. The government does these good things. It'll be there tomorrow. I'm contributing. I'm good. Right? So it's a way of looking at nothing, of not living in reality. And it's just, it shows you what we really are inheriting in the 21st century, that we are still stuck here. Or, royal we. I hate to eat that. But.
And as much as we feel that it's managing our anxiety, the anxiety never goes away. You notice that, especially when it comes up against the truth.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
so that's a big indication. Like, feelings are very great indicators of the thinking we have done and the thinking we've failed to do.
Right. Okay? And that's so true about the anxiety doesn't go away. I mean, just, a silly example, but I mean, pretty consistent. If something really terrible in my life happens on Friday, and I decide to spend the weekend at, Foxwoods Casino with gambling and cocaine and hookers, there's going to be more anxiety on Monday, right? There's not that, like, that is not effective anxiety management. And I think as we're applying these ideas to society or civilization as a whole, you're right. As people keep trying to find these mythologies and these stories and push that anxiety down, in many, many ways, it's just getting worse. I mean, if we look at the size of, the expansion of the state just on this landmass in the last 200 years, the things are not, people's anxiety is not dissipating.
No, the biggest government on the planet is a definite manifestation of this anxiety that people think that they can't cope on their own. They can't be 100% responsible, so they have to exploit others. They have to sacrifice others and themselves to try to live a decent life. I mean, it just makes no sense, because the more restrictions, the more regulations, the more taxation that we have in our lives, the less able we are to be fully human. And that's the opposite direction we need to go. We need total freedom. We need the ability to be completely responsible and happy. I mean, it's a win-win situation, and it's really disheartening to see how so many people can be so in favor of something that destroys their very livelihood and destroys the future of their kids and the families. It's really agonizing.
To be continued in part 3.
Good evening. The first, the second, third, and last presidential debate.
I'm Jim Lawson,
but now we've heard all the talking points. So let's try to tell the people tonight some things that they haven't heard.
Thank you, Bob.
Tom, thank you.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Well, thank you, Tom. Thanks for the university.
Our best days are ahead of us.
Senator McCain's statement earlier said that he thought the fundamentals of the economy were sound.
Let's look at it as created by the national taxpayers union and the citizens against government ways.
Senator McCain talks a lot about earmarks.
Likes to talk about earmarks a lot.
Let's be clear about earmarks.
Earmarks account for $18 billion of our
last year's budget.
When I'm president, I will go line by line through every item.
Page by page.
So when Senator McCain proposes a $300 billion tax cut to some of the wealthiest corporations in America, I want to provide for a tax cut for 95% of working families.
95%.
He says that he's going to give you a $5,000 tax credit.
But I want to give every American to have a $5,000 refund tax credit so they can get the health insurance you want.
Senator McCain mentioned looking at our records.
And so let's look at our records.
An across-the-board spending freeze is a hatchet, and we do need a scalpel.
Senator Joe Lieberman and I, alternative fuels, wind, tide, solar, natural gas.
Four out of five.
When the war started, you said it was going to be quick and easy. You said that we were going to be greeted as liberators. The last eight years,
thinking about the middle class.
My friends, and you really have to pay attention to words.